I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Kurt Anderson's new novel, True Believers, is narrated by a 60-something lawyer named Karen Hollander, who was on a short list of nominees for the U.S. Supreme Court. She removed her name because of a secret she has kept since the 1960s when she was coming of age. She decides to write a memoir and reconstruct the pivotal events from her past. When she was young, Hollander and her friends loved to act out scenes from James Bond spy novels, books they absolutely adored. Later, they got caught up in the radicalism of the 1960s. Kurt Anderson joins us on Radio Times. He's the host and co-creator of the Peabody Award-winning public radio show Studio 360. It's a co-production of PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC Radio in New York. And Kurt Anderson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
I'd love to begin with a reading from the very beginning of your brand new book.
All right. My publishers signed me up a year ago to write a book, but not this book. A candid and inspirational memoir by one of the most accomplished leaders and thinkers of our times, their press release promised. They think they're getting a slightly irreverent fleshing out of my shiny curriculum vita, a plain-spoken, self-congratulatory chronicle of A Worthy Life in the Law and The Modern Triumph of American Women, which they're publishing, ho-hum premise notwithstanding, because I've written a couple of bestsellers and appear on TV a lot. By far the most interesting thing about my life, however, is nowhere in my resume or official bio or Wikipedia entry. I'm not exactly who the world believes I am. Let me cut to the chase. I once set out to commit a spectacular murder, and people died. But it's not a simple story. It needs to be unpacked very carefully, like a bomb. Trust me, okay? I'm reliable. I'm an oldest child, highly imperfect, by no stretch a goody-goody, but I was a reliable U.S. Supreme Court clerk and then a reliable legal aid lawyer, representing with all the verve and cunning I could muster some of the most pathetically, tragically unreliable people on earth. I've been a reliable partner in America's 19th largest law firm, a reliable author of 4 books, a reliable law professor, a reliable U.S. Justice Department official, a reliable law school dean. I've been a reliable parent, as trustworthy a servant, teacher, patron, defender, and worshiper of my children as anyone could reasonably demand. And I think that on any given day, at least one of the two of them would agree.
That's Kurt Anderson reading from the very beginning of his new novel called True Believers. And when I read that, I was thinking, if I met someone and they use the word reliable as many times as Karen Hollander does, I would not trust them.
Well, there you go. There
I
you
would
go.
Think of them, why are they forcing me to think that they are reliable?
Because she's narrating this extraordinary life that in which she reveals things that are astounding and unbelievable, and so she's eager to it's a bit like a defense lawyer, although she says she's not defending herself, making the case to the jury.
Should we trust her though?
I think you should trust her.
And where did she come from? And it's interesting, I know you've been asked this before, but to be a male author with a female narrator.
Yeah, I'm not the first male to write female, and women write males all the time.
Yes.
In this case, it made sense to make her a woman once I decided to tell it in a first-person voice, partly because, as you know better than I, women's lives have changed a lot more and a lot more interestingly over the last 45 years than men's. And so, sort of to the degree this her story is the story of the last 45 years, it seemed that seemed the more interesting, fruitful point of view. Also, in the story that I tell, there is a love triangle, and it seemed better for me to tell this story from the female point on that triangle.
And did you enjoy that part?
I enjoyed the love triangle or writing as a woman?
Writing as a woman.
I'd written big women characters in previous novels that I very, very much liked writing and sort of fell in love with each time I created them. And so when it came time to do this, it was daunting, and that's why the question is asked. Oh, how did you do this, Mr. Anderson? But I was up for it. And, you know, I live in a household full of women.
But to use the I. I mean, it's just interesting, even that reading coming out of your mouth.
Yes, indeed, which is why I'm so happy that on the audiobook, a woman reads.
Is that true?
Book. Absolutely.
Oh, who reads the book?
An actor in Los Angeles whose name I currently can't remember.
That comes with age as well. Comes with the 60s. She has, your character, Karen Hollander, she has type 1 diabetes. And I read that you also have type 1 diabetes. Is that right?
I do. And she was diagnosed at age 18. I wasn't diagnosed happily, fortunately, glass half foolishly, until I was 32.
Really?
But yeah, so, and I'd never, so I thought, oh, that's material. I can give her this because, partly because I've never seen the interior psychology of what that's like dealt with in fiction. So that's something I can do that most people, 99.9% of writers can't. And to the degree the novel is a lot about memory and mental acuity and the versions of reality that people see, it made sense for the story as well.
Well, she writes about the kind of mental weirdness that she experiences taking insulin, and she says, you write, a responsible diabetics play doctor with themselves every day. All day.
Yeah. No, it's really true. And again, when she's older than I am, she got it younger than I did. So in 1967, when she gets it, it's a much more complicated, hassle-laden process than I, in 1987, was lucky enough to enter into. No, it's people, you know, it's one of those things. And it's not the center of the story, but it is one of those things that people, oh, yeah, juvenile diabetes, yeah, people can take care of that, and it's fine. And it is, but the details of it, playing doctor with yourself all day, of this very occasional mental weirdness that happens in the titrating yourself is you know, I felt it again in a novel where that's the place, unlike movies, where you can really get into the heads of people and express what's going on in the interior. It seemed like a good subject to go for.
But it's interesting. I mean, not to belabor this, but having to, I guess, sort of monitor your glucose levels or your insulin levels and just how you feel.
Yeah. No. Well, exactly. And playing doctor, taking, you know, pricking your finger 15 times a day.
Is that right?
Yeah, oh, sure. If you do it responsibly, as Karen and I do. But no, it is. It's a discipline like anything else. And again, I mean, compared to other chronic things that people have to deal with, it's not so bad. Yeah. But it's not nothing.
It's interesting to me that your narrator, Karen Hollander, she's a piece of fiction, wants to write a memoir. So the idea of a fictional character writing about their life, I mean, I found that intriguing, to be honest with you.
Well, I found it intriguing once I was into it and realized this sort of meta thing I was doing of this novel that is a nonfiction book and that is somewhat about this woman who, as a young woman, realizes that her great tragic flaw is over identifying with fictional characters. So I got to a certain point in the book where she says, after her plan in 1968 has gone awry, she says, I'm not a fictional character. I'm not Emma Bovary. I'm not somebody from Poe. And it was funny to me to reach the point where my fictional character in her nonfiction book is saying, I'm not a fictional character.
And that's, I guess, one of the joys of creating a character like this.
Well, because you don't know, and that's an example of when you start, you know where it's going in terms of basic plot and story, but you don't know all kinds of places it's going like that and themes that emerge until you're into it.
Well, and one of the fictional characters that she and some young friends just adore are the characters out of the James Bond novels.
Yeah. Yeah, they're 12 and 13 in 1961 and 62 at the very height of the Ian Fleming Bond novels, just before there has been a James Bond movie, and at the height of the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and John F. Kennedy's favorite book is From Russia with Love, and they're just obsessed the way kids a few years later were obsessed with J.R.R. Tolkien. And they go overboard, but in a kind of cute, childish way of acting out little James Bond plays in the real world.
And did you, at that age, 12, 13, were you a James Bond aficionado?
I was not a James
Bond.
I was an aficionado of The Prisoner and of Man from U.N.C.L.E. and of these terrible movies called the Matt Helm movie starring Dean Martin. So I was definitely into the spy thing, But I'm partly because I'm a little younger. The movies were James Bond for me by the time I was in that head.
One of the James Bond stories that she and her friend seem to really love is it just went right out of my head.
Casino Royale.
Casino Royale. Thank you.
They do, and in fact, on their first, they do these little missions where they go out without really telling their parents what they're doing and play different characters. And she goes into an arcade, this on the sort of wrong side of the tracks, and she feels like she's in the casino in Casino Royale.
Well, and also we're going to play at the very end of the show the theme from Dr. No. That also seems to figure into their fantasy life.
It does indeed. And yes, there's, in fact, the moment of introducing James Bond in the novel at the end of their eighth grade year comes when that very theme is played just after the movie has come out.
So have you read all the James Bond novels?
I've read nine of Ian Fleming's. I have read none of the ones since Ian Fleming died. But yeah, and I was surprised and interested in how different they are than the movies, not just in incident and plot, but they're better in a way than lots of the movies. They're not as gadget driven. They're not as arch. That James Bond is more of a kind of he's not an existential crisis, but he's not just a fun and games callous killer as he is in the movies.
Well, and those early movies that I remember so vividly, they're so kitschy. I mean, they're so the color. They're so fake looking in so many ways, and of course Sean Connery's a great James Bond, but and the women all are sort of cut out of the same kind of fantasy.
And whereas there are women in the Ian Fleming novels, I'm not suggesting he was a proto-feminist by any means, but they have jobs and they are spies and they are intelligence operatives and they're not just people for Sean Connery to get into bed.
Did you have a gang when you were growing up? Because reading about these kids, I had a little gang, and I remembered just all the things that we did with such intensity.
Exactly right. I had a couple of gangs. I had my grade school gang, and then my gang changed in junior high. But absolutely, and from when you're little, playing army, and as certainly boys did, and then again, I didn't go to the extent of pretending I was a spy that these kids do, but I had a little metal file box with 3x5 cards with dossiers on my neighbors, for instance. Why? I don't know. I did. And I bought a listening device at Radio Shack to listen to people. And so I had enough of it that I could extrapolate into this fiction.
Well, it's fun to be a voyeur, don't you think?
To be
a voyeur?
Yes. That's what writing and reading fiction is all about.
And that's Kurt Anderson, our guest today in Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called True Believers. He's also the host of Studio 360 and joins us on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Westchester University supports WHYY. Westchester University's Master's of Special Education degree will be offered in Philadelphia starting this fall. Teachers interested in a graduate degree in special education can attend classes at Westchester University's 7th and Market Street location, just one block from Independence Mall in downtown Philadelphia. Applications are now being accepted. Details at wcupa.edu/philly. That's wcupa.edu/philly. Westchester University. Learn more.
Beautiful bearded iris are outstanding garden plants, but they are plagued by the pest known as the iris borer. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll tell you how to outwit this hungry, hungry caterpillar. Plus, the latest news on honeybees and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Whether it's on small screens or large, Bill Bellamy has been making audiences laugh for years, and he doesn't have to look far to get his material.
My life is hilarious. I'm not even just saying it. Like, my life is bugged out.
We'll hear more about Bill Bellamy's hilarious life and work. It's part of our Make Me Laugh summer series. That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Kurt Anderson. He's the host of Studio 360. He co-founded Spy Magazine. He's written for movies, theater, and TV for Time, The New Yorker, New York Magazine. Also the author now of 5 books. The new one is a novel titled True Believers, and it's about a 64-year-old lawyer named Karen Hollander. It flips back and forth between the 60s and contemporary times, or just around contemporary times. She has a pretty impressive resume. She loves James Bond novels, and she has a deep, dark secret. And the lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I don't want to give away too much of the story, but jumping off from these kids playing James Bond spy novels, turning them into games and palling around, segueing from that to the 1960s, and a different kind of perhaps palling around or playing.
And a different kind of fantasy enacting, really. And it was interesting to me, and why I made her exactly the age she is, she's born in 1949, mm-hmm. is 12 and 13 when they're doing these James Bond things in a very different 1960s, in, if you will, the James Bond, now Mad Men, early Mad Men, 1960s. So in her and their adolescence, from ages 12 to 18, everything changes. I mean, it becomes the 60s, the late 60s as we know them, corresponding precisely with the incredible change that every adolescent goes through from 12 to 18 as well. So that's sort of why it all does that. And their ideas of themselves as, we can get away with anything, and we're clever, and we've sort of hardwired this James Bond espionage thing into our lives, it sort of segues almost seamlessly and without them quite realizing it into serious business in 1967 and 68.
Doesn't every 15-year-old think that they're clever? I mean, they may think otherwise, but there is a part of just being that age where you feel like, I know something you don't know.
Exactly. And you think you're immortal, essentially. And at that time, suddenly, for the first time maybe ever, the whole culture was saying, yes, young people, you know, what do you think? What do you want? What are you doing? I mean, the whole culture was sort of reinforcing that adolescent self-importance that always exists.
Well, and you also, or she, I should say, your narrator talks about all the things that were created in the 60s, stereo records, the Beatles, Big Pens, Instamatic cameras, live transatlantic TV broadcasts, in-flight movies, printed circuit boards.
And just in that passage, just in 2 or 3 years in the early 60s, this extraordinary explosion of fun and
Frisbee, and, yeah. Slip and slide, silly putty.
Yeah.
We have a similar thing today, don't you think? Where we just seems like every day there's a new invention or there's something added to our cell phone.
Well, definitely that. I think those things, when they came kind of one at a time, just like television. There were only 3 networks, of course. Everybody discovered the Frisbee at one time. Everybody discovered Silly Putty. Everybody suddenly had a touch-tone phone. And today, yeah, there's all this new stuff, a million new apps and things, but it's like so much today, more fractured.
Your narrator, Karen Hollander, she has a deep, dark secret.
She does.
I'm not going to give it away on the radio. But it seems that this, and we all do, I mean, some are deeper and darker
yes.
than others. But it seems that this deep, dark secret has defined her in many ways and, in a sense, forced her to live perhaps like a spy, a double life.
A little bit. I mean, the thing about her secret and the way she and her friends who survived this thing they did in 1968 are different from the standard Bernardine Doran radicals of the time is they were never apparently caught or arrested or indicted or anything. So they were just allowed to walk away. So it's this strange thing of, man, we got away with it. But then, like, when is the other shoe going to drop? Is the dread in the back corner all her life? And as a lapsed Catholic who has never really lapsed, she finally feels in this book that she must confess.
I'm curious why you were interested. I mean, I think you gave away more than I did about this deep, dark secret. But
well, she says on the first page she plotted a murder.
Okay, fair enough. But that she did, unlike Bernadine Dorn, she didn't get caught.
Correct.
Why did that interest you?
Because
do you think there are others like her?
No, there may well be. But no, what interested me is she is more like every woman, in a sense, or every person. I mean, I think a lot of people, especially starting with the baby boomer generation, felt as though, man, the stuff I got away with as a kid, I did this, I did this, kids today. And so, and to live this sort of bohemian, pseudo-revolutionary life and then become a famous, fancy lawyer, again, it's more the story of that generation, I think, than somebody who went off the deep end and stayed there, like Bernadine Dorn. She goes off the deep end and then scurries back onto the dock.
But does that, I mean, obviously it's a pernicious secret in many ways, but does that undo, I guess, her accomplishments?
I don't think it undoes anything. I mean, it would be interesting. I mean, and she talks about, oh my God, when this book comes out, I'm going to be loathed and detested and demonized. Undo? No, I don't think so. I think it, however, as she knows, it will become, you know, the lead in her obituary.
Yeah.
This thing that no one but a very few people have known about for 45 years.
In that reading, you know, I'm not who you think I am, or that she's pretending. Do you think we're all pretending?
Well, I think I do think that. Yes, is the short answer.
Are we pretending?
I think we all have secrets. I think we're all pretending. I know the first time I had a job running a thing, running a magazine, running a serious big magazine, the first day, I was like pretending to be a boss. I was acting the part of a boss. And when you have kids, you're kind of, okay, how are parents supposed to act? I'll act like that. So, yeah, I think we all do that. And as we said, I think all of us have parts of ourselves in this TMI age that we keep secret.
Too much information.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, maybe it's a little slight different take on that, which is, and I have felt this at times, where you feel like you are an imposter, that you're, you know, maybe you're faking it, but you feel like, how did I get this job? I mean, what did I do
I don't know if that's universal, but like somewhere, I mean, yes, many, many of us, I think, feel like frauds all the time. And you know, you in your introduction said all these things I've done. I have almost made a career out of serial imposters. I wasn't a radio person. Suddenly I'm a radio person. Well, yeah. I hadn't written novels until I was 40. Suddenly I'm writing novels. So yeah, I think it's kind of endemic in our culture.
Do you think it's unique to our culture?
Oh, I don't know about our culture, but I can't really speak for it. With any, you know, authority beyond our culture.
Your narrator, Karen Hollander, she seems like she's saved everything from her life.
She has, and I haven't. That's one of the many ways, most of the ways in which we are different. I am the opposite. I every few years purge everything I have, purged way too much, like when I threw away all of my vinyl record albums at a certain point.
Oh, you did. Oh, goodness.
But yeah, she keeps a lot, which you know, and like the successful lawyer she's been, and of course lawyers keep files and files and files, that I don't know what was cause and effect, if she became a lawyer because she's a pack rat or vice versa. But yeah, she's kept a lot of stuff. So again, in her I'm reliable, she has a basis for that.
And that's Kurt Anderson, our guest today on Radio Times. He has a new novel. It's called True Believers. We've been talking about some of the characters and some of the themes and ideas in this novel. And I'd actually love to have you read another section. And just to jump ahead here, she decides to write a memoir. And, of course, she's with this deep, dark secret. It opens up all sorts of possibilities.
And one thing she does, as she's, again, in the present day, she is not only getting a friend in the intelligence community to help her investigate herself, she is also doing research, like reading books by 60s radicals. Until the last year, I'd never read any of the memoirs published by the old 60s radicals. There were people who genuinely believed they were making a revolution, who had set off bombs in government buildings for years and really did go underground for a decade. Now I've read every one, and I find them unsatisfactory. They are too fondly sentimental about their crazed young selves, coy and opaque about exactly what they did and disingenuous about their motives. They don't quite regard their crimes as real crimes, and definitely not their madness as madness. For them, mistakes were made has no ironic stink. They mainly blame the man for their mistakes and still think of themselves as noble veterans of a great and ongoing crusade for justice. They give sincerity a bad name. I'm not saying every 60s radical was obliged to undergo a political apostasy or that their careers and education and prison reform and all the rest have been unworthy. The balance in their memoirs between candid explanation and self-justifying rationalization, however, is tipped way, way too far toward the latter. They remind me very much of members of the Bush administration talking about the wars they waged and bungled.
And again, that's Kurt Anderson reading from his new novel, and it's called True Believers. Do you think the 60s was a fake?
No, I don't think. No, the 60s were not a fake at all. The 60s were a historical inflection point, the likes of which I don't expect to see in my lifetime. Again, they were huge and mostly positive for, in my view, for the culture and people and women and the tolerance for weirdness in general. But I think we've developed this story, this narrative of the 60s, where the left thinks it's all good and the right thinks it's all bad. And I think it's much more ambiguous than that.
Well, let me quote something you wrote in the New York Times.
Okay.
I know you're ready for this. It came out on July 4th. And you, just picking up on what you just said there, you write, people on the political right have blamed the late 60s for what they loathe about contemporary life. Anything goes, sexuality, cultural coarseness, multiculturalism. And people on the left buy into that, seeing only the 60s legacies of freedom that they define as progress. But what the left and right respectively love and hate are mostly flip sides of the same libertarian coin, minted around 1967. Thanks to the 60s, we are all shamelessly selfish. A bold statement. I know you got a fair amount of response to that, but it seems like you are blaming, to use an example from today, the excesses of the financial industry on the anything goes 1960s.
I think it has until now unseen roots in that. Yes, I do. I think that this. The do your own thingness. We know that now I can wear blue jeans to a radio interview and listen to rock music until I die and all the rest of that stuff and be bohemian and live as I want. That's what we think of as the liberty that the 60s allowed. But I think the other part of that was what pretty soon after the 60s were over began this you know, essentially during the Reagan administration, this era of deregulation economically and do your own thing economically and outsource jobs and all the rest. I really think it shares a kind of taproot with what the left regards and liberals regard as the good 60s.
Well, but I wonder whether the 60s were a reaction to the Mad Men type 50s. And so you had, you know, women in many ways living in these straitjackets.
For sure.
And then you have the 60s, which was do your own thing, which I think for women, you know, meant a lot of freedom. And then you have
the African Americans and lots of other people.
Exactly.
For sure.
And then you have the 80s as a reaction to the 60s. And now, you know, we're.
I don't think the 80s was a reaction to the 60s. I actually think that the 80s were an extension of the 60s in a different guise, to the degree the late 60s were, among other things, about hedonism and I want what I want and it's if it feels good, do it, and it's my own truth. I do think what again, the left regards as the bad stuff of the last 25 years, and I agree with that in many ways, has some roots in that as well. And again, I want to make clear, as some of my readers didn't understand sufficiently, is I'm not saying, you know, there are unequivocally good, unselfish results of the 1960s, of civil rights, of the rise of women, gay rights, so on and so on. But I'm talking more about the sex, drugs, and rock and roll part of the 60s.
Well, and again, quoting from your article, do your own thing is not so different from every man for themselves. If it feels good, do it, whether that means smoking weed, watching porn, never wearing a necktie, retiring at 50 with a six-figure public pension, and refusing modest gun regulation, or moving your factories overseas and letting commercial banks become financial speculators. I mean, you've made a connection between the pot smoker and the entrepreneur who moves his factories overseas.
Well, I want to do what I want to do, and the what the social norms are and what the civic good is, be damned. Again, I'm happy. I'm a libertarian too in many ways. I would legalize a lot of drugs. I'm just saying we have to look carefully at the whole thing we bought. Coming out of the late 60s.
Well, and just to further this, let me quote a letter actually to the editor here from Jeremy Varon. He's wrote a book called The 60s, a Journal of History, Politics, and Culture. And he said, so Kurt Anderson lays today's corporate greed and the mega indulgences of the 1% on the 1960s era hippies who gave us organic farming, the feminists who created rape crisis centers, and the gay activists championing basic human rights. A generation of free market ideologues who hacked regulations, unions, and what was left of the New Deal play no real role in his account of the ascent of the corporate license to pollute.
You see, I'm not saying that anything is bad about women's rights or rape crisis centers. That's all good. What I'm saying is that there is a family tree, and just as we are related to chimps and bonobos, so is kind of wild free marketism related to counterculturalism. So to me, it seems inarguable, and to me, it's interesting to see that people who have a certain fixed romantic idea of the 60s just don't want to blur that up.
Well, and I don't have I'm exactly the same age as your narrator, and I don't have a romantic view of the 60s because there were many things that I found bothersome. I guess what I don't understand is making that connection between and it wasn't the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but the idea that you could address the problems of poverty or begin to accept gay marriage, for instance.
Well, but look at all of the collectivist redistributive stuff of the 60s, which we've put that away. We are not doing that anymore, and that's off the table. That part of the 60s. Essentially was killed and nipped in the bud. I'm saying that the residue of the 60s today that exists are this and this and this and this, and some of them are good, some people think are good, and the same, and different people think that's good and bad, different people think that's good and bad. I'm just saying they came from the same place where the personal and the focus on personal individual liberty was everything, and I wouldn't trade. I wouldn't go back. But in the Mad Men years, in the 50s years, people who ran businesses were far more understood their duty to their communities and their country and their employees because social norms told them to. You know, we threw a little bit of baby out with the bathwater, is what I'm saying.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Talking with Kurt Anderson today on Radio Times. He is the host and co-creator of Studio 360 and author of a new book called True Believers. We'll be right back.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY-TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you two tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit whyy.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Sigourney Weaver. She plays the Secretary of State in the new miniseries Political Animals. Another strong woman in a series of strong women she's portrayed. As a girl, she put herself in the shoes of any hero, like Davy Crockett.
I didn't ever think that being a girl meant that I couldn't wear buckskins and shoot bows and arrows and stuff like that.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Millions of kids who get free or reduced-priced lunch at school could be going hungry this summer. Also, reviled buildings, the ones everyone, except maybe the architects, think should be torn down. We'll look at some of the worst of the worst. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Kurt Anderson has a pretty impressive resume. He's the host of Studio 360. He co-founded Spy Magazine. He's written for movies, for theater, and TV. He's also written for Time, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine. And he's the author of 5 books. A new one called True Believers is a novel, and it does flip back and forth between the 60s and contemporary times, narrated by a 64-year-old lawyer named Karen Hollander. She has a pretty impressive resume as well. We're talking about this novel, also an interesting piece that Kurt Anderson wrote recently in the New York Times, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You had mentioned business people in the 1950s, and going back to the piece you had in the Times, you write, "My conservative Republican father thought marginal income tax rates of 91% were unfairly high, but he and his friends never dreamed of suggesting they be reduced below, say, 50%.
And now they're, of course, at 35, and it's everything sensible people can do to try to get them raised to 39. So, yeah, times have changed. I mean, and it's interesting how radically, in a fairly short period of time, the norms can change, as they did in the 60s. As I would argue they've done in this particular instance in the last 5 or 10 years.
But it is interesting, and I always hate to make generalizations or even in stereotypes, but it seems that it's conservatives today who don't want to talk about raising taxes. I'm thinking Paul Ryan and others. You've got Obama talking about, you know, raising them around the edges.
No, the far right, which is to some worrisome degree the tail wagging the Republican dog these days, is in many ways, it seems to me, as I've spent time the last couple of years thinking about the 60s, are the equivalent of the new left today. Uncompromising, righteous, kind of nihilistic, I don't care what happens, this is right, this is what I believe, to hell with you all. It's as though, I mean, imagine if, 50 new left people had been elected to the House of Representatives in 1970. That's kind of the mirror image
of what we're seeing now. The Abby Hoffmans of the world, right?
Well, almost.
But it is interesting. The 60s, of course, very much influenced by the Vietnam War. Today,
totally.
we're sort of half engaged in one war and half engaged in another war.
No, well, we partly because of Vietnam and the debacle and horrors that it caused. This country, now understands that wars can only be waged at a certain level with a certain loss of life. That is the biggest difference about then and now is this war that we were going all in but not quite all in on, and that 18-year-old men were subject to the draft, which is all the difference in the world. If an analogous thing, that or an analogous thing, were to happen today, you'd have a very different situation today.
Karen Hollander has a terrific granddaughter. I mean, she plays, I liked her very much.
Good, good.
And she's an activist.
She is an activist. She was an activist, and I finished this book months before there was such a thing as Occupy Wall Street. And
she goes to the G20 summit.
She goes to the she takes the bus with her friends down to the G20 summit in Miami to protest and occupy it, and persuades her grandmother Karen to be their sort of protest chaperone and go with them.
And do you see that activist spirit alive?
Oh,
today?
I do. I happen to have a nephew who occupied Wall Street and slept outdoors after I kicked him out of our apartment, of our house in Brooklyn, at that park, and is still active. So, and I wrote a big piece, my sort of annual piece of journalism in Time magazine last year about protesters all over the world last year, and unquestionably, I mean, in the United States, there is no dictator or Vietnam War or one thing that will galvanize the protest yet, but give it time. I mean, this may be sort of equivalent to 1964 when, you know, 1967 and 68 were just months away. Who knows?
Were you a protester as
I was a little
teenager?
Young to be a protester. Really? I was, my first protest when I was 15 in 1970s. So, I mean, but then my sense of, oh, I'm missing it. I'm here too late. And then I get to college in 1972. Oh, it's all over. So, no, I felt as though I was, you know, the little brother running to catch up but never did.
Interesting. Let me get, looks like David from West Windsor to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to comment on the connection he made between business ethics or the unfettered business and the unfettered personal drives of the 60s.
Oh, dear.
The same tendencies were there in business long before the 60s, going back at least to the Gilded Age of the 1890s, to the business of America is business in the 1940s and 50s. What's good for General Motors is good for America. The idea that an unfettered business climate is a positively good thing, or at least is acceptable, did not begin at the 60s.
Yeah, David, we're losing
connection.
Yeah, we're losing you. Appreciate the call, and I think we heard what you say, which is there was the Gilded Age. And
sure. Since the Depression, however, certainly in all of our lifetimes today, and since World War II, there was this compact made where all the boats were rising and where rich people grudgingly but did pay top tax rates of 70, 80, 90%, where a CEO would never dream of paying himself 300 or 400 times what his average worker was paying. So, of course, economics are economics and capitalist economics are capitalist economics, and twas ever thus and twas ever will be. However, something dramatic changed in the last 25 years. And that's all I'm saying. And again, I'm a big believer in cycles. You know, next year, the year after, let's talk 5 years, the pendulum may be swinging back. Not so far.
But I wonder whether, and I'm no historian, whether the 50s was a kind of an anomaly.
Well, I believe that in many, many ways, the whole period from the war through about 1975 or 80 was a kind of wonderful anomaly in so many ways of, you know, journalism thriving, all kinds of anomalous things were going on. What we grew up thinking was normal may have been a weird outlier period.
Except if you were African-American, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or gay,
yes,
closeted.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, again, and that's my whole point, my own personal point about history in this book is it's never simple. It's not black and white. It's you know, there has been progress made, but it's, you know, as ever, two steps forward, one step back.
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Since you're a much better reader of your work than I am, I would love to have you read that little paragraph. I'm passing the book across to you where I put those arrows. And this is, again, going back to the book.
Karen is driving in Los Angeles, driving her granddaughter to the airport, and listening to NPR after she's left her off at the airport. The woman reading the news on Morning Edition is black, I learned not long ago from a friend who works at NPR. I'd had no idea, because there's nothing identifiably African-American about her voice. NPR has a bunch of black on-air talent, but because they all sound white, my friend told me in an embarrassed whisper, and because it's radio, nobody realizes it. We get no credit. What we'd kill for are some first-rate journalists with, you know, African-American names. Khadisha, Jamil.
Do you feel that way as well?
I'm not an NPR executive. I have nothing. I don't work for NPR, so I don't
no,
know.
No, I understand.
But it is interesting to me. It is very interesting to me that at this particular historical point, where you know, some African Americans sound as we have said, African-American or not, that on radio, it's just a voice.
Well, and that's what I frankly have always loved about radio, which is that, you know, as a listener, you don't know.
Exactly. We could be naked right now. They have no idea.
Fair enough. I have to say, I really love your show, Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
Something that I make sure that I listen to every week. And you're the co-creator. What was the idea behind the creation of Studio 360?
Well, the germ, which was Public Radio International's, was let's do a weekly magazine show about the arts and culture. Mm-hmm. And Public Radio had tried that, apparently, time and time again, and it never quite worked. And how they came to me to ask me to do this, I have no idea, really. But they did. So then we took that germ of an idea and said, Let's figure out how to do this, and 12 years later, we're still doing it.
And one of the series that you do that I think is so wonderful is the Icon series, where you know it might take Monticello or something, excuse me, and construct a whole narrative around.
Yeah,
it.
We've done a couple of dozen of these at this point, American Icons, where we, instead of we sort of have the luxury, thanks to the National Endowment for the Arts, or for the Humanities, rather, the luxury of stepping back and really looking, focusing deep on one work of art or culture, whether it's a novel or a piece of architecture or the Barbie doll or Buffalo right. Bill or whatever, and really make a full fledged radio documentary about those things, and we're about to do a new series of them that will launch later this year.
Oh wow! And as you said, they approached you. You'd never done radio before as a regular gig.
I'd only done this, talking to people like you, flogging my writing. No, I'd never done any broadcasting gig, and they. So again, it whether I'm good at it or not, it is. I am happy that public radio is sufficiently take a risk, innovative, to say, oh, let's see if this guy can do it.
Yeah, but it's different kind of writing, isn't it, for the radio than it would be for a novel or some of the other pieces that you've written?
Completely. Actually, my very, very first job right out of college was writing radio essays for Gene Shalit. The guy who used to appear on the Today Show every day and who also had on the NBC Radio Network a daily essay. And that was me in the late 70s.
Oh, wow. And you went to Harvard.
I did.
Which is also where your narrator went.
Another thing we have in common. Although, again, she graduated in 1971 and me graduated in 1976. It was extraordinary to me, once I started doing the research and talking to people, how entirely different those 5 years made. It was a real one prism in which to look at those years and how they changed. I mean, it was extraordinary. But yeah, we both did.
I have a sister who's about 7 years older than me, and it's almost feels like another generation. That her experience of the 50s and 60s is so different from
exactly.
mine.
Exactly. Precisely. No, we were living cat years and dog years then.
So are you working on another novel?
I should be, and I have two file folders, virtual file folders, full of notes and ideas for one of two different books, and I'm going to give myself, as soon as this wonderful book tour is over, I'm gonna give myself the rest of the summer to try to figure out which one of those I want to tackle.
Oh, so you, this is what you do? You keep literally a file folder?
Yeah, a computer file folder of notes and ideas, and there are more than two. There are two things that I think could make a book. Actually, one's a novel and one's a nonfiction book, and I'll figure it out.
I notice in this book there's a lot of dialogue, a lot of talking. I mean, it seems like you.
Yeah.
Is that fun to write?
Oh, indeed. And it's interesting. When I was writing my first novel 15 years ago, right in the middle of that, I back in the day when you would pitch an idea for a movie and a studio would say, yeah, here, write it. And I did that. And so I took several months off to write that screenplay. It unlocked my ability to understand and enjoy and write dialogue. It really helped me become a better novelist. So, yeah, I do like writing dialogue. I think I have a fairly good ear for it. But writing prose in general and certainly writing novels, yeah, they're both writing for radio and writing it, but really, as apples and orangey as one could posit.
And were you a good writer as a kid? I mean, were you the kind of student where a teacher would say, you know, Kurt Anderson, you got a gift here?
Yeah, And that's why I ended up doing it. I at one point I thought when I was going to college, my sister, 7 years older than I, is an academic and a professor, and she was doing that when I was in high school and college. And I thought, oh, that looks like a pretty good gig. But because teachers kept saying, they didn't say, you know, you're a brilliant scholar, but they did say that paper was well written. I sort of took that as a nudge in the right direction. No, and I wrote for school newspapers and then college magazines and so forth.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of the reasons I put Karen and her friends in suburban Chicago, feeling as though I probably had a, you know, that there is something about being a kid in the Midwest in the 1960s that I would feel some sympathetic understanding to.
And you think that's different from a similarly aged kid on the East Coast or West Coast?
And I think enough to, I mean, the job of a fiction writer is to imagine different countries and people and eras, and but yeah, I think in terms of the real texture of life, especially when you're a kid and you're alert to all the little textures and objects and things, yeah, I think there's probably something. I think I have significantly more in common, given where I grew up, with somebody who grew up in Wilmette, Illinois, than I would somebody who grew up in New York City or Los Angeles, for sure.
Well, Kurt Anderson, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Total pleasure for me. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And Kurt Anderson has been our guest. He has a new novel, and we've been talking a lot about it. It's called True Believers, and he also is the host and co-creator of Studio 360. You can actually hear that you can hear that program Saturday mornings at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you can also tune in Tuesday nights at 9 o'clock, and we are playing some music from James Bond, from Dr. No, just to pay homage to some of the characters in this book. Bob Olsey, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.